The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Well, welcome to this week's edition of Capital Thinking. I'm not Kevin O'Neill. I'm Mike Dino from Denver, Colorado. I'm a senior policy advisor from our Patton Boggs office here in the Mile High City. And I'm guest hosting today's show in place of my Washington colleague, Kevin O'Neill. It's great to come from Denver, Colorado, today with the show. We got a beautiful day here in Colorado. The snow-capped mountains have been getting a lot of snow, so our skiers are happy. And we have a great visit today from our president. President Obama is visiting just to the east of here at one of our Air Force bases, and we'll be highlighting alternative energy and our solar energy industry here in Colorado. So today's topics for our show are very, very pertinent for the president's visit. We're going to have a chance to talk about the State of the Union that was a few days ago and what's happening on the Republican side of the presidential race. And then we'll look at a few things happening internationally and as well as domestically. So I want to kick off today's show with two of our more prominent Washington folks from Patton Boggs, Nick Allard and Stephen Diaz-Gavin. Nick chairs our Patton Boggs lobbying, political, and election law practice, and Stephen is one of our attorneys who combines public policy skills and advocacy with his legal acumen and litigation experience. Nick and Stephen, welcome today.
Glad to be with you, and nice talking with you.
Thanks,
well,
Mike. Good
to know, and it's very pertinent that I'm hosting the show today, and we got the president here in Denver, Colorado. We're one of the swing states. We're part of Super Tuesday coming up on, I think it's February 7th or 6th. I can't remember exactly what day. I'm not looking at my calendar, but we're getting a lot of visits from the president, and we'll get a lot of visits from certainly his counterparts.
Before we get to what's going on with the election,
why don't both of you give me a sense of what your reaction to the State of the Union is?
Nick, why don't you start?
Sure. I mean, I thought it was first of all, the president's back to the future. He's back with you where he was nominated and then kicked off the campaign with that terrific convention speech in the Mile High Stadium, or whatever you call it now.
Yeah, it's now Sports Authority Stadium, Nick, and I'm looking straight at it right now as I speak to you.
So I think his speech was a return to form. I think generally observers feel that it's, you know, both sides of the aisle, that it was one of his better, more energized, more connecting speeches that he's given in recent memory. And it was interesting when he first started off with these soaring references to the great challenges that we face and we're not going to give up. I mean, it was focusing a lot on foreign policy, which reminds people of his successes. I couldn't help but think about that scene from Animal House where Belushi says, you know, did we quit after the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? But he moved on from that, then spent a lot of time talking about the devastation of the economy and how it's tough, acknowledging, you know, that we still have a lot of progress to go. And I think that the tenor that he struck reflected that, you know, he has a hard case to make to the American public on this issue, because it's like what I have to tell my doctor when I get on the scale. You know, it could have been worse, which is always a tough argument to have to make. But he's, you know, he laid it all out there. And so I think, you know, on balance, it was a strong, good effort and, you know, really the, not only the State of the Union, but the beginning of his campaign. And he took off from there, you know, on a trip that very much looks like a campaign trip.
Mike, I think a little differently. I think this was clearly a campaign speech, as one would expect in the speech that a president gives in the final year of his term. But I think, despite some of the nice discussions, the nice rhetoric in the beginning, and some of the foreign policy achievements that I think the president should be given credit for, I think that Nick hit it on the head that the key issue is the economy. But the problem, as I see it, is the president didn't propose really anything serious that involves growth of the economy. This whole idea of the tax fairness question, which really I think is a chimera. It's not there. You know, you've got a situation where the top one, according to the CBO, the top 1% of income earners pay 19% of their effective income in taxes. You've got a situation where the top 10% of taxpayers are already paying 71% of the total federal income tax receipts. And this idea of having some kind of a millionaire tax where the effective rate will be 30% for anybody who earns over a million is only going to produce a lot of people that are earning $990,000 a year.
Wow. So, Stephen, I mean, do you think this was more of a campaign speech than
something that was oriented
for just, you know, the State of the Union?
I think, you know, there will be few State of the Union speeches that will ever go down and win the Nobel Prize in rhetoric. But and so most of them are laundry lists. But there wasn't certainly he had all kinds of things for all kinds of people. But when you really look at it, the serious questions involving economic growth and particularly the looming tax hike that comes at the end of the year when the current marginal rates expire and we go back up to 39%, that's a very serious tax situation that we're confronting.
So, Nick, in what is continued to be a recession economy,
despite growth, I think it's a problem.
Yeah. So if Stephen's right, if this was a campaign speech, do you think the president convinced the American public he should be reelected?
Well, of course it's a campaign speech, and I agree with Stephen. But I thought he struck an interesting tone in that campaign speech in that he was both he walked a tightrope before both, you know, laying out the case for reelection, but also in a way that was an offer of a handshake across the aisle that couldn't be refused, at least posing in an irresistible way, you know, in a bipartisan way, as willing to reach across the aisle. So there are a number of occasions when, you know, the camera would focus on Eric Cantor, for example, and I saw this, and Cantor was sitting there stone-faced and then suddenly realized he should be applauding. And so when he was talking about tax extenders for working Americans and so on. So, you know, I think it was an interesting speech. The president making the case is almost irrelevant at this point, given what's going on in the other party. I was struck earlier this week by the Wall Street Journal basically saying, I think they explicitly said, that the Republicans deserve to lose, and of all places. So, you know, I think that it's almost, you know, the president's at this point, and we've got a year, a little less than a year to go, but at this point, it's almost his reelection to lose and think, unless things change dramatically, rather than, you know, a contest for who's going to win, given what's going on the other side. I mean, Stephen, I'm sure, has some thoughts about that.
Well, I think that a reelection is always a referendum on the president and the president's performance in the previous 4 years, and the president's performance on the economy has frankly been dismal. And I think that again, I go back to this idea that there is really no, when you simply talk about austerity and don't talk about measures to try to achieve real economic growth, and not just playing around with subsidies in the tax code, but really seriously looking to how you're going to have a fiscal system that encourages growth is a problem. I think that Nick, I think, is correctly pointing to the fact that we are a long way at this point, I think, from getting a a nominee in the Republican Party. You have Romney as a consistent factor, and then the not Romney. And the flavor of the month right now is Newt Gingrich.
So what's going to happen in Florida as we turn toward, you know, the Republican side and the campaign that's been waged for over a year now? What do you guys think will happen down there?
I'll let Stephen handle that.
Well, I think we, in full disclosure, of course, that we represent, that the law firm represents Mitt Romney's campaign. But I think that it's certainly the poll that came out, the Rasmussen poll that came out this morning has Mitt Romney up 39-31, but it's very hard to tell in Florida where things are going. Newt Gingrich certainly shocked the Romney campaign with the size of his victory in South Carolina. And among other things that are going to be important for Romney is how many people who had already voted for him before that happened, and whether he can, his superior organizational capabilities as a result of his money advantage will be able to turn Florida. But it's pretty, I think, I wouldn't venture a guess as to who's going to win in the win of Florida primary.
You know, one thing I'd note with respect to Gingrich, and I've been getting a lot of calls, Mr. Gingrich getting a lot of calls about this, you know, the president made this proposal, you know, to stop lobbyists from bundling political contributions. And, you know, footnote, full disclosure, I was part of a task force at the ABA that came out with almost the identical recommendation, and the task force was comprised of professional lobbyists, election lawyers, Republican, Democrat, law professors, and the heads of nonprofit, ethics and government kind of organizations. So there's a lot of consensus on that. But I couldn't help react with all the problems in the country and sort of the vast issue generally of politics and money that the president focusing on, it's, there he goes again, you know, red meat out to the constituents, pick on lobbyists as if that's really the source of the problems that we have. But it's also in a week where I couldn't help resist all the phone calls I've been getting, and I said, you know, it's tough on your self-esteem as a lobbyist, you know. You've got the president picking on you, and then you have everybody reminded that Mr. Gingrich is a lobbyist. And you know, haven't we suffered enough? So, you know, it's an interesting context. And I do think that Romney is scoring heavily in that regard in pointing out that whatever the technical requirements of registering as a lobbyist, that Mr. Gingrich, you know, certainly was not being paid to be a historian, but was trying to influence, you know, federal policy and give people, you know, guide them like the Italian captain in the ship, guide the direction we're heading.
Nick, we probably have about 15 seconds. I Super Tuesday actually is March 6th, but here in Colorado, we'll be bunched in with Colorado, Minnesota, Missouri on February 7th. Do you think for Gingrich, it's just going to be really hard once you start getting multiple states on any given election day to really survive?
No, I don't think it'll be hard for him. I think this is not business as usual, and he's not a retail politician state to state. He's got big ideas and a mass appeal. So, I mean, Stephen may feel differently, but I think that's not, you know, we're in a different playbook this year.
Gingrich has been able to establish his candidacy on the basis of this, of the very numerous debates that the Republicans have had, and it gives him an advantage in free TV that he may not have otherwise had. But by the same token, to the extent you've got caucus states coming up, you will see the same kind of advantage, for example, that the Obama campaign had over the Clinton campaign in 2008. This is where, in those kinds of states, money counts, because money allows you to put together an organization. And unless Newt Gingrich is able to do better than he did in the Virginia primary, where he couldn't get enough signatures to qualify for the ballot, it's going to be very tough for him.
Well, and I know, you know, in Colorado, we really haven't seen any of the candidates here yet. We still, after Florida next week, we have, you know, Nevada and Maine, you know, in front of us. So we've had a lot that, you know, we've had a lot of things going on in other parts of the country before they make it here. But I know Colorado is, you know, one of those bellwether states, and we're excited to have folks come here. So you guys have been great today. This has led some wonderful perspective. And Nick and Stephen, thanks for your time.
Our pleasure. Anytime.
All right. We'll be back here in Denver, Colorado with Capital Thinking soon. Thank you very much for listening to our first segment.
Stop.
stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
Oh, he's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Well, welcome back to Capital Thinking here, hosted by Patton Boggs, and this is Mike Dino in the Denver office today, guest hosting for my colleague Kevin O'Neill. We're always glad to have a chance out here in Denver every once in a while to be in on this show and talk with our folks, not only from the Denver office, but from our Washington office and certainly Dallas and other offices we have around the country, New York and New Jersey also. On our next segment here, we have one of our colleagues from Washington, Vince Felici. Vince is one of our folks who combines both a good political and business background and working with our clients on both federal, state, and local levels. Vince, welcome.
Well, Mike, nice to be here today.
I'm glad you're on. I know you've been in my seat hosting the show before, so you get to do both every once in a while, huh?
Well, it's my pleasure, and you do a good job hosting the show. Thanks for having me on today.
Thank you. Well, and I know we've got an important issue here, particularly one that's been in the public forefront for at least the last 2 or 3 years, and one that affects people. Sometimes they don't always know it, but it's the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, and that's been in the paper of late. And why don't you give us some background on this bureau and what's been happening of late with its leadership?
Well, thanks, Mike. As a member of our financial services public policy team, we're monitoring this closely for our clients in the development of this brand new bureau, this brand new government agency. A little bit of background: the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau was created by the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Bill, which was, as everyone knows, a response to the financial crisis of 2008. Inside of the 2,000-page bill was the law to create, for the first time, a bureau very similar to the Consumer Protection Bureau for products, Consumer Products Protection Bureau for financial products. And that was very controversial at the time. It was very controversial when it was put into the bill, and frankly, towards the end, for those that may have been following it, and there may not be many that were following as close as we were, but towards the end of the creation of Dodd-Frank, it really boiled down to there was a trade between the Democrats and the Republicans, where the Democrats said, we have to have a Consumer Bureau in this bill, and the Republicans said, well, we have to have the end of Too Big to Fail. And so you've got both those things being stood up now, now well over a year of this bill being signed to law, where you've got the FDIC forcing banks to write living wills, a part of the bill, and you've got now a Consumer Bureau being stood up. Now the Consumer Bureau is being, has been fraught with a lot more politics because, the beginning of last year, 2011, senators on the Republican side made it clear to President Obama that they felt strongly that the way that the Dodd-Frank bill created the agency, its independence, its one sole director that can make rules, was something that was unpalatable. And therefore, until the agency's fundamental architecture was changed by legislation, that they would stop any nominee from being confirmed. Because the Dodd-Frank bill states specifically that this bureau cannot make any rules until it has a Senate-confirmed director. So a year went by. The president of the point decided not to appoint Elizabeth Warren, who had been one of the individuals who really thought about the agency, created the agency in concept, and then the Senate followed, and the process followed her idea. She was so politically charged that the White House decided that it'd be better not to have her as the nominee, and went with the former Attorney General of the state of Ohio, Richard Cordray. And nominated him in 2011. His nomination was then quietly filibustered by objection by a number of senators, and therefore the bureau sat dormant because it couldn't again do anything until it had a director. So now let's fast forward to 2 weeks ago, two three weeks ago, right after the new year, President Obama went to Ohio to give a speech and announced that he was going to grant Richard Cordray a recess appointment. Now the controversy now hits where they weren't necessarily in recess, and I don't want to filibuster myself. So Mike, I'll let you.
I know where you're coming from. Technically, they seem to still be in session by some technical rule, right?
Yeah. So what's happened is in the last couple of years, Democrats and Republicans, regardless of who controlled the chamber, started putting the chamber into what's called pro forma recess, which meant that every 3 days someone, usually a senator from nearby Virginia or Maryland, would come into the chamber, gavel it open, gavel it closed, and therefore technically it's still in session, as a way to stop the president, and the Democrats did this as well, stop then-President Bush from making recess nominations because they believed that that meant they were in session. Now, the White House got a ruling from their Justice Department, a memorandum to the president stating that based on what they believe the law to be and the constitutional, their view of the Constitution where it discusses recess appointments, which are in the Constitution, granted to the president, as a power he has when the Senate cannot respond to him, that he had the ability to do the recess appointment while they were in this technical pro forma session. So, the senators disagree, and so now we have basically, to boil all that down, is that the president sort of kind of gave a real strong sort of NFL straight arm to the Senate and then moved ahead without him.
Well, and is this more out of frustration or is this just politics as usual? I mean, you know, what's your read on this?
Well, I mean, I think it's both. I think that there are many in the Democratic Party base who really want to see the Consumer Bureau get going and start working on a non-bank institution. So on the substance of it, what the Consumer Bureau will do now is have the ability to regulate non-banks. And so what are non-banks? Non-banks are payday lenders, mortgage originators, brokers, right? Wire transmitters, people who transmit funds, like Western Union for people, and create disclosure regimes, do exams, and issue fines. They do not have a criminal power to charge anyone with any criminal infractions, but they do have the ability to levy fines. To be more specifically touching on your question, I think that when it was done and how it was done was definitely political.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at what the Senate can do now in response to the stiff arm of this recess appointment, it's very limited. Congress could pass a bill stripping Mr. Cordray from being paid. A very simple bill, just the executive branch shall not pay Richard Cordray for doing the powers, which would not pass in the Senate. So the House could pass that. It wouldn't go anywhere in the Senate, and frankly would probably be welcomed by the White House politically because they believe they have the political high ground here. And I think they do, frankly, if you look at the polling and, you know, sort of where Wall Street still resides in the mind of many Americans, a vast majority of Americans. And then they could sue. A senator could go into federal court and ask for standing to say that he or she was harmed by not having the ability to vote on the nomination. It's unclear if the court would give them standing. But it looks like from what we're hearing is that the Republicans won't do either, and what we'll do is allow a business group to file suit and then probably file an amicus brief along with that, because it's entirely possible that a court would rule with a company. So if you're a company that's going to get forced to have an examination of your books and your processes, or if you are granted a rule that harms your business, if they issue a rule that harms your business, or if you are levied a fine upon by the Bureau, you could litigate, and from the lawyers, and I'm not one, but the lawyers that I work with here at Patton Boggs and others that I've talked to, it looks like there'd be a good case to litigate and say, all right, it's fine that you said that I should do X or that you think I should pay this fine, but the way that we read the law is that there's no Senate-confirmed director, therefore there's no power for the Bureau. And that looks like that could be a decent case. And so that's probably what we're going to see here, is that the politicians are going to step back on the Republican side and let the actual companies affected by this file for relief in court.
Well, in your experience, you've got an extensive experience in following public policy in the political world in Washington and elsewhere. I mean, has anybody ever taken retribution against a recess appointee in the way you've described?
No.
Okay. But to your point, you make a great one. I mean, it seems that, you know, these recess appointments, the folks in them, from a perceptive, view, it really undermines their authority, and then legally, possibly undermines their ability to administrate their powers. And so, is there any benefit to doing these recess appointments?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, that's a great question, and I think it's a coin toss. It's a coin toss because, one, it gets the Bureau going and it gets them able to do what they believe the policy objectives are. But two, I mean, frankly, Mr. Cordray can't serve past 2013. He's got an appointment now for 2012 and 2013. He can go there and do that work. But it does muddle things. Now, then again, for those that want the Bureau to stand up and do something, then at least the answer will be done in court if there's a court, if there's a case taken to court. And I think we'll just see how it plays out.
Well, great, Vince. This has been very insightful. Certainly it's something that does affect the public, though, they don't always notice. And we're glad you joined us today on Capital Thinking.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
All right, we'll be back shortly after a break here for Patton Boggs Capital Thinking. Thank you very much.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjo Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Well, welcome back to Capital Thinking today. This is Mike Dino from Patton Boggs' Denver office, and I'm guest hosting for my colleague Kevin O'Neill today. We got a great day in Denver. As I mentioned at the beginning of our show, we have President Obama visiting our great city and focusing on our solar industry. And as I mentioned in previous chances to host this show, Denver is one of the larger communities in Colorado in terms of a federal footprint. We have a lot of federal employees, maybe second to Washington, D.C. And speaking of Washington, D.C., I have one of my colleagues online now, Dan Waltz. Dan works with clients who need help with cross-border transfer of goods and technology. And he's going to talk to us today about the Iran sanctions, something that seems to make it into the paper every week about what's going on over there and the tensions we have with Iran. Dan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Mike. I'm glad to be here.
Well, and in November, speaking of the president, he issued an executive order that expanded the list of activities that can expose non-U.S. companies to U.S. sanctions. You know, tell us a little bit about that, and you know, is there what makes that unique compared to what's been happening already?
Yeah, the last few months has seen just a lot of development with respect both to U.S. sanctions against Iran and also other countries getting more active. I mean, we in the U.S. have had an embargo with Iran for years, which prohibits U.S. companies from doing business with Iran. In 96, we passed a law that targets non-U.S. companies that make big investments in the Iranian petroleum sector. That was amended in 2010 to increase the list of things that a non-U.S. company can do and will get them in trouble, like exporting refined products to Iran. The theory there was, although Iran exports a lot of crude oil, it lacks refining capacity, and it's dependent upon imports of refined products. But those were laws passed by Congress and something the administration had never
initiated, this notion that we're going to target non-U.S. companies. This November executive order is a departure in that the administration, on its own initiative, issued this executive order that says if you, non-U.S. company, export equipment to Iran that increases their ability to refine petroleum, or if you export equipment that will be used in their petrochemical complex, manufacture of things like polyethylene, we will expose you to the potential imposition of sanctions.
Hmm.
So it adds to the list of activities that non-U.S. companies will undertake only at risk, and it represents a departure because, again, previously it had only been Congress that had passed laws targeting non-U.S. companies. Now the administration is jumping on that bandwagon.
And so with your background in international issues, I mean, what was the response from the community around the world?
Well, it's fascinating. When the U.S. passed the original Iran Sanctions Act in 1996, some of our best allies and trading partners howled in protest. The European Union initiated a dispute settlement proceeding before the WTO, and they were arguing this is an infringement of our sovereignty. What's striking now is that many of our allies, including primarily or most visibly the European Union, have jumped on the sanctions bandwagon. So it may be an affront to their sovereignty, but you don't hear those howls of protest. Mm-hmm. Indeed, earlier this week, the foreign ministers of the European Union sat down to hammer out a final agreement pursuant to which the EU will prohibit the importation into the EU of crude oil from Iran.
And so, you know, we see a lot of things in the paper about Iran and, you know, what they're doing. They sentenced that gentleman to was life for spying. Supposedly, they've held people up. I mean, are these actions in response to some of what the average person reads in the paper about what they're doing with American citizens?
Well, it's a response. What they are doing with American citizens is in part a response to this ratcheting up of sanctions by the U.S. and by other countries.
Wow. And so, earlier in January, the administration announced the imposition of sanctions under the Iran Sanctions Act against three additional companies. Where are they from, and what did they do to warrant that? I mean, this puts kind of an example of how this is being put into action, so that would be great to understand.
Yeah, I mean, the original Iran Sanctions Act was passed in 1996, and no sanctions were imposed, despite the fact that there were non-U.S. companies making big investments in Iran's petroleum sector. In 2010, Congress had enough, and, of course, the level of concern about Iran was increasing. So they amended the act to increase the list of things that can expose a non-U.S. company to sanctions. And one of those things, as I mentioned, is exporting refined products to Iran. So earlier this month, the U.S. actually imposed sanctions against three companies, and it was because they were exporting refined products to Iran.
Hmm.
One of them was a Chinese company, which is a first. Many had thought that the administration might be timid about going after Chinese companies because we depend on their cooperation both with respect to Iran and with respect to a variety of other important issues, including North Korea, for example. So finally, the U.S. has imposed sanctions against the Chinese company. Another was an oil company in the UAE. Again, an ally and a country that is largely cooperating with us in our efforts to pressure Iran to drop its nuclear program. And finally, had an oil company in Singapore. But I think this shows the U.S. may impose sanctions against companies even if they're located in a country that is generally considered to be an ally cooperating with us on our Iran policy.
And, you know, when you look at these type of sanctions, and you know, there's this big prediction that gas prices are going to start skyrocketing, and some of the news reports have certainly blamed it on the fact that Iran is a lot of the oil from their country is being
prevented from getting into the market. They're making a lot of threats about, what they'll do as it relates to, being a part of the world community. I mean, in your view, are they contributing to the higher costs at the pump at this point?
Well, what I find striking is a law that was signed by President Obama on December 31, further tightening sanctions on Iran. As I said, we've had sanctions on Iran. We've made them tighter and tighter. The one thing that we never targeted was the export of Iranian crude. We didn't allow it into the U.S., but we never tried to pressure our allies into stopping their purchases of Iranian crude. And that's for two reasons. A, impact on the oil market, and B, anger and resentment on the part of our trading partners and allies.
Mm-hmm.
But this law that was passed by Congress with overwhelming support and signed by President Obama for the first time says we will sanction non-U.S. banks, including the central banks of foreign countries, if they engage in transactions with Iran's central bank.
Hmm.
And it's the central bank that's the clearinghouse for oil payments. So suddenly, for the first time, Congress, over the objections of the administration, has taken that fateful step and said, yes, we are finally going to target exports of Iranian crude.
Well, in your estimation, because of that, I mean, can we blame some of this on our own actions in terms of the increase at the pump, or is it just the market in general that is causing our issues?
I think you can blame is perhaps the wrong word, but yes,
attribute.
The U.S. action, and as I mentioned, the EU this week also announced that it will be prohibiting the importation into the EU of Iranian crude, have had an effect on the market. The U.S. government is talking to the Saudis about whether they can increase their production. There are provisions in the U.S. law that enable the U.S. to delay the imposition of sanctions if our own studies indicate that cutting off Iranian crude would create a shortfall or a price spike in the market. But both the U.S. and the EU have now laid down a marker. The U.S. has been traveling to visit with our allies, countries like Japan, Korea, China, Turkey, in an effort to get them to agree to cut back on their purchases of Iranian crude. And so this is the latest front in this diplomatic and economic warfare.
Well, and I, on the way into to work today, NPR had a clip from when George W. Bush was president, and he was explaining our problems are that we're addicted to oil in the Middle East and with countries like Iran and such. And so you've heard this for a long time. You're a veteran at Patton Boggs. In a political year, you hear a lot of folks both on both sides of the aisle continuing to point fingers at the Middle East and trying to figure out how we can avoid dealing with these. But, I mean, it seems that we never do, and, we continue to see these sanctions and that. I mean, do you see us ever changing the way we do business, at least in the foreseeable future?
Well, I think you should take with a grain of salt some of the grandstanding that's engaged in by our elected representatives. First, we have diversified the sources of crude oil that we import. Second, we actually have fairly solid and amicable relationships with many of the countries that in the Middle East from which we import crude. It's easy to demonize Iran. It's easy to paint with a broad brush and act like every government in the Middle East is suspect. But the truth is, we need crude. We get it from a variety of sources. We're clearly targeting Iran, and don't anticipate problems with other Middle East and Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
All right, Dan. Well, listen, that is probably a good place to stop. We need to conclude this segment, but thank you very much for taking the time to give us some perspective on this international issue, and we're glad you joined us here on Capital Thinking today.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. We'll be back to Capital Thinking in a moment after this break here from Denver, Colorado. Thank you very much.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Well, welcome back to Capital Thinking today. This is Mike Dino from Denver, Colorado. I'm in our Patton Boggs office here in the Mile High City, and I'm guest hosting for Kevin O'Neill today, and have one of my wonderful colleagues from Washington, D.C. on with us, Norma Cram, who is the co-chair of our firm's Homeland Security, Defense, and Technology Transfer Practice. Norma, it's good to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much. It's good to talk to you today.
Well, we're going to be talking about cybersecurity, and what are the most critical issues facing cybersecurity? You know, we always hear about people's information being corrupted and stolen or lost. What do you think we're dealing with as we move forward?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Mike, because I'd say even a year or two ago, I'm not sure that the general public would actually know to talk about those issues or even cybersecurity. And today, almost on a daily basis, we worry about those hacks. We worry about data security and privacy issues. And I really think that we have sort of a twofold challenge. The first is that nation states, criminals, and even what we call malicious actors are actively trying and unfortunately succeeding in hacking into government systems, private sector companies, and I guess you could say at best they're stealing intellectual property. At worst, what they're doing is they're doing more than that. They're stealing people's money. They're stealing not only IP, but they're also in some ways being very smart. They're lingering in these public and private sector systems and stealing information that people don't even know about. And that may be the worst of all. By the time that people find them, you know, bad things have happened. And at the end of the day, as we think about the second biggest challenge, 85% or 90% of our critical infrastructure is actually in the hands of the private sector. So if any of these actors hack into these systems, it's not just that they can take them down, it's that our economy and our health and our national security are really at risk.
Well, and is Congress, I mean, what's their view on this? Are they doing anything about it?
Well, Congress absolutely agrees that this is a pretty serious problem, and they've been working on it, I think it's 2.5 years now. And we've seen that the Senate and the House have taken a much more active role in this in the last, I'd say, 6 to 10 months. The Senate right now has a bill that they're working on that they're talking about trying to get passed through. And I think their challenge at the end of the day is what's the right balance? How do you manage the fact that the private sector owns a lot of these systems, but, you know, do they need to regulate? Should they not regulate? How do you protect people's privacy? I mean, I think those are some pretty sticky issues that they've been trying to work through.
And there was some discussion of giving the president emergency powers in the event of a cyber attack. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, I think that whole discussion really scared many, many people, including the American public. And when we've seen in other countries around the world, in the Arab Spring and others, people are concerned that, quote, the president could take down the Internet. And I don't think that that's what the intent was. But at the end of the day, giving the president additional powers is a dicey situation, and we need to be careful. When the Congress had talked about it, I think their view was that in the event of a cyber emergency, that the president would have the powers to direct the private sector to take, I guess, whatever actions that the government thought needed to be taken, but that's a bit of a slippery slope. And I'm not sure that you were going to see that in the final legislation. I think the Congress has been clear that the president shouldn't have the power. You know, there is no kill switch to take down the Internet. But at the end of the day, I think if there is some sort of an attack on the United States, in this case a cyber attack as opposed to a physical attack, I would guess that the president and the White House believe that they have the powers to do what's necessary.
Jeez. And I guess McAfee, one of the big software companies that does provide protection for software and hardware on computers, they issued a 2012 threat prediction about anticipating more attacks in the U.S. You know, what's your view? Do you think that they're just scaring people or that they're accurate?
You know, I think the report had a number of really good points, and it expressed concerns that many, many people have. I mean, they did highlight the challenges of critical infrastructure. We talk about Stuxnet, which was the attack on the Iranian nuclear power plant. I mean, people are very concerned about hackers really hacking into any of these systems and doing terrible things. And they did talk about hacktivism, which may be a new term of art. That's a little bit of the WikiLeaks.
Like the hacktivism. Which we saw recently with the folks who weren't happy with PayPal, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's why when we talk about cybersecurity, it could be, it ranges from actual nation states and criminals and malicious actors to just people around the world who have social and economic issues and concerns, and this is a new way that they believe to express their concerns. But, you know, I don't know that everyone agrees with the approach that's taken, especially if there is actual harm incurred, and that, you know, you can be on either side of the issue. The other piece that they did talk about that many people are concerned about is the mobile threats. So with the rise of smartphones and other things, there's many applications that you can have on your smartphone to do lots of things, shop, bank online, but there's concern that there are potential security issues with those applications where people can hack into them to get into your bank account. There's lots of discussion of people hacking in and actually turning on your phone, turning on your video camera. I mean, things that you'll never know about that are very concerning. And, you know, there's a lot of things in this issue that are a problem, but we have to be careful. We have to balance both people's privacy and First Amendment rights along with, you know, security concerns, which are a pretty big issue.
Well, Norma, I know you need to depart us early today because of another commitment, so this has been fascinating to learn about this, certainly something that's in the paper regularly, and I know that you'll certainly keep an eye on this for our clients, and certainly it's something that the public will continue to read about. So thanks for your time today and joining us.
Well, thank you so much. I'm sorry I have to leave early, but I'll look forward to maybe coming back and talking about this some more.
All right, Norma, you have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
All right. As we mentioned in that segment with Norma Cram, we talked about the president, and I know that he's out here today in Denver, Colorado. He's out here to tout a very comprehensive energy approach that includes opening up public lands for clean energy investments from the private sector. He's actually going to be speaking at one of our Air Force bases, and part of his message will be encouraging the military to go green. And ultimately, he'll talk about tax incentives that he hopes to see put in place for the domestic clean energy sector. He will not be speaking to a public audience out here in Denver. It'll be a closed group, and, you know, of course, that always gets people riled up when they don't have access to the president. But he's making a quick stop here. It's part of his five-city stop. He was in Arizona yesterday and Iowa, and we're glad to get him. This is the third time the president's been here since September. It'll be a big day for us here in Colorado. And with that said, I'd like to conclude our Capital Thinking Show from Pat and Boggs for this week. Thank you very much for joining me, Mike Dino, and our guest today. And from Denver, Colorado, the Mile High City, I hope everybody has a great day and gets a chance to see a little bit of us on the press with the president being here in Colorado. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.